From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 15th day of February, 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net. We'll hear from Emerson Nafziger. He spoke at this morning's Crop Management Conference in DeKalb. That's where I'm coming to you from today. And as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too, with Mike Tenura at T-Storm. Storm weather. That's tstorm.net online during this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.17¾. It was 6½ lower. The May contract at $4.29¾, down 7½. And December new crop down 7½ cents as well, $4.56¾ the settlement price there. March soybeans at $11.62¼, down 8¼. The May at $11.66, down 10¼. November $11.40¾, down 14¼. For the day, bean meal 380 lower. The bean oil for the day down 35 cents. Wheat futures soft red down 18½ at $5.67 in the March. The hard red at $5.75¾, down 12 cents. Ellen Dearden from AgriView out of Morton, Illinois, now joins us, filling in for Matt Bennett, who is traveling on late notice. Thank you, Ellen, for doing that. First, also thank you for being on the panel in the morning for soybeans at the All Day Ag Outlook. That's coming up on Tuesday, March 5th. Looking forward to that and having you there.
Sounds good to me. And boy, these grain futures really took it on the chin pretty hard today on Thursday. We've got just about everything looking pretty bleak. We made new contract lows in the corn very easily this morning, chipped away at that downside. For a while, it looked like there wasn't any sell stops sitting under the market. But we certainly closed low in the day's trading range, just fractionally off those lows. I would say kind of the same thing in the beans. We did see some pressure, particularly on the new crop beans, with the November beans down in that 1140 range. We've got some pretty decent support down at $11 to 1120, but that's still lower than where we are right now.
And I would say that the USDA numbers that were reported out of the Ag Forum this morning maybe had an impact. You'll have a better idea than I do. However, old crop carryout at 315, new crop, and this may have been what traders saw, was 435. They were expecting it. But when you see that 400 million bushel number, it just feels pretty big.
It does feel weighty. And the last time we had a number even approaching that was in 2019. And, you know, the fact that USDA is looking for carry out at the 435 level came even with exports above this year's export expectations at 1.72 billion bushels. So next year they're looking at 1.875 without raising the exports in beans and really in corn as well. We'd have carryouts even larger than the ones that USDA put out today.
Yeah, and their season's average price, since we're going through the numbers for soybeans, was $11.20. The season's average price for corn was $4.40. A stocks-to-use ratio there of 17.2%. The current year stocks to use is 14.9. 10% is what's considered kind of pipeline average, not pipeline, but average. I'm wondering if there are some numbers within that soybean or the corn chart S&Ds that you found of interest.
I just think these export numbers were pretty blue sky. That was the thing that jumped out at me, and that was the case for corn, beans, and wheat as well. These price numbers, really, when you look at where November beans closed today at 1140 and a fraction, 1120 for an average farm gate price seems rather high. That's kind of startling when you think about it.
Yeah, and I was thinking on the old crop pricing today when you're considering looking forward, but on old crop, there will be many producers who now have spot bids under $4 for corn and maybe under $11 for soybeans, I would think. Do you have an advice for them?
Prices under $4 for corn look pretty bleak. I would think that if you've been holding on to corn for this long, you might as well hold on for a little bit longer. But I would go ahead and sell the July or sell the July futures on a hedge to arrive and at least get some of that protection. We've got a spread there of over 20 cents going from March to July.
Thank you much for filling in. I appreciate it, Ellen.
Thanks, Todd.
Ellen Dearden is with AgriView from Morton, Illinois, and will join us at the All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana on Tuesday, the 5th day of March. I hope you will, too. Tickets are available now at willag.org. Well, as you know, I am at the Crop Management Conference being held in the DeKalb area today. Emerson Nafziger, Extension Agronomist Emeritus, spoke to those gathered and discussed how it is that they may or may not know about the new technologies that are coming and how useful they are based on the data that is available. Emerson, through the slide set that you were showing to those here, it appears that there's a lot of data that comes in, but maybe not enough data all the time to support the claims being made.
Well, I think the big change has been that we've gone from university, you know, land-grant university scientists finding and new helping develop and show a new technology and then extension taking it to farmers. That model that held certainly the first half of the 20th century, and today it's considerably different than that. We still pay attention to things like row spacing and plant population and tillage versus no tillage and nitrogen fertilizer use and rates and so on. But today, a lot of the new products being offered to producers are things that are novel products in a sense of we didn't know we needed these, and we can't, when we see them, we don't know if they did something, and so we really would like data on them. But the question becomes, if this is a product that a microbe, for example, that you put on seed that affects the roots in some way or helps fix nitrogen, how do we know whether that's a product we should use? And I guess is another simple way to say it is the marketing has sort of taken over and is leading these now rather than the agronomy. And agronomy is still important, and I'm not saying the marketers don't use agronomy, but it becomes, you know, can we convince you that would you like a product that does this to your plants? And if farmers say yes, they say, well, ours will do that. So in some ways, the marketers need to create the market, and because farmers, you know, didn't naturally one day just come to a conclusion, hey, I think we need some new microbes on our seeds so we can get better yields. The yield effects of these are likely to be pretty variable among fields and among years, and that makes sense. You know, if they work best or do the crop more good in a cool soil than a warm soil, then it's obviously it's not going to be very consistent across years. So this is just part of the change in scenery today that we see in agronomy and in products that are being marketed to help increase production. If they don't increase production, you know, we can't get paid back for them. So we want to know that, and just really difficult today to know whether these things produce enough increase sometimes to pay their cost across acres and years. And that's the difficult part of this.
I think there was a point at which you were hopeful that with the machinery, the technology that was in the cab, yield maps, those sorts of things, that farmers would put their own strips into the field to test, to see what was happening. Would you still like to see that happen? Do they have the technology?
If I were farming, I would be very interested in doing that. But I can kind of understand why maybe it never really took off. We've had yield monitors for 25 years. They've gotten better and better. Their calibrations are better. We now have the large planters with the split tanks. We could put treated seed on one side of the planter and untreated on the other side and just strip a whole field like that. That would be a powerful way to test something that's new. And we don't need statistics and so on. As long as we remember where we put it and where we didn't, we would get a very good estimate in that field of the effect of whatever it is that we did. But most farmers may be interested in that, but may also be working with their retailers. And, you know, the retailers may not be opposed to farmers doing that, but it's, do you really have time? Do we want to really mess with doing this? And so there's probably not enough, if, especially if you use a product that you can't really see that you used it. I mean, it doesn't change the shape or size or look too much of the corn crop or the soybean crop. Then you're always asking that, well, why am I doing this? You know, so if I talk to enough people and the people that sell these products are convincing and take my questions seriously and so on, and I'm convinced that I'm going to get enough to cover the cost. These are often fairly low-cost inputs. When I say low-cost, you know, cost a bushel or two. And so that becomes a question that people may say, well, why not just use it? As the commodity prices drop some, we're going to be all more sensitive about what we spend, even if it isn't very much. And that also means now instead of one bushel, it costs two bushel or even three bushel to use this product of corn, then we may be more reluctant to do that. I don't think that there's very much evidence that people have really missed out on these products that we'll, just for purposes of today, we'll call sort of unproven, at least not proven to the extent that something like nitrogen fertilizer or herbicide are a proven idea that always gives us something. But their effects on yield are likely to be fairly small and inconsistent. And so it may be easier for people that say, well, if it does work, I surely ought to be using it, and I'm not going to just wait around until I have a more firm yes than I have today in terms of making use of it.
Without being a statistician or really into statistics, when you see something or a farmer would see something that they're interested in, how much data do you think they need behind it to prove to you that it could be useful in your field?
Well, that's a big part of the problem. If something varies across a field, as I made mention of, you know, if it needs warm soil, it works, or cool soil, it works, warm soil, it doesn't. If you have something like that that almost certainly varies by field and by year and by place in the field and this sort of thing, we're probably never going to have very convincing data. And let's say at its best it will do five or six bushel, and, you know, at its worst it does nothing or even minus one or two bushel. So it becomes kind of impossible to tell. And people can set their own standard and say, well, I'm going to do strips, you know, in four fields for 2 years, and if I don't see it doing anything, then I'm not going to use it. That's a reasonable approach. Then what do you do if you see an effect of six bushel 1 year and then in one field and you don't see it in the other fields of the other years? Do you use it then or not? And we are always fond of saying, well, just do some more research with it. But this will not necessarily be satisfying. People that need to reach a decision and don't want this constantly being in front of them, well, use it or not use it, might just say, well, I don't think that's enough that I'm going to depend on it and use it. And others might say, well, if it can do that, you know, it only costs me a little bit to put it out, so you know, if it becomes a seed treatment or something like that, then we'll have no problem doing it. But these many new products today, novel products that are being marketed, and this is a whole range of products, you know, don't have a whole lot of convincing data behind them to say, well, you know, every time we use this, we can expect some yield increase from it. But good marketers can still make a good case for things, and if they're trusted people, why people will still decide to use them. A lot of science, a lot of investment is going into some of these new products. There's venture capital, startup companies. There's a lot of marketing push out there to make products and get them onto a lot of acres. And so that's partly fueling this. When prices are high and farmers are making a lot of money, and we don't have to go back many years to see that, you know, that's an easier decision. And that might have people using things that, you know, for a few years that they're not really sure about at all, but figure, well, why not? You know, I've done cleared enough on these acres, I can use a few $5 or $10 treatments and not worry too much about it. But most of these are not going to solve a visible, long-standing problem in your fields, I guess, would be one message, because they address things that are hard to see and deficiencies that may or may not exist in the crop. There's no indication that every field is just waiting for just that right product that you're going to put out there this next year and that it'll yield a lot. And on the other side, a lot of people have had really high yields sometime in the last 3 years or maybe all 3 years, and it's not at all clear that their crop had some glaring deficiency that left them short 5 or 10 bushel.
Thank you much. That's Emerson Napsiger. He is Extension Agronomist Emeritus from the University of Illinois and spoke here at the Crop Management Conference in DeKalb.
Mike Tenora now joins us. He is the president, CEO, and owner of tstorm.net online, and checks weather forecasts and global growing regions for climate changes across the planet. Mike, thank you for being with us today. I appreciate that. I think we have a lot of ground to cover, so let's begin actually in a broad scope across the planet, looking at the wheat growing regions. This is a crop that comes up every month of the year. How are we doing?
Well, we're doing about as well as you can possibly expect at this point in the year. Most wheat areas across the Northern Hemisphere are normal or wet. This includes all the winter wheat across the European Union, also in Russia and Ukraine. Even China, which is typically dry at this time of the year, is getting some rain. And if you look at what's been happening in the United States, only 1% of the U.S. hard red winter wheat crop and 1% of the soft red winter wheat crop were drier than normal over the last 90 days. On top of that, we're even seeing some big rains in the Middle East. Typically in parts of Iraq and Iran where you grow some wheat, they get about 1.5 inches of rain in February. Well, we're looking at 1.5 to 3 inches of rain over the next 2 days. So this is a pretty widespread story. And if we just get a few more rains over the next few months in these different areas, you're going to at least have a normal crop, and anything beyond that, and you're going to have some pretty big crops. So that's probably the biggest thing to watch for wheat over the next few months.
In South America, I'd like to begin with the Argentine growing regions. They've had some heat, some dryness, and now some rainfall. How are they doing?
Well, yeah, they've had an interesting situation throughout the growing season where it was really nice and wet until the middle of January. Then all of a sudden they had a big heat wave and a lot of dry weather for about 3 weeks. Well, that came to a crashing halt last week. And at this point, things are looking pretty good. They've already had normal rainfall for the month of February, just based on what happened earlier last week. So even if we don't get any more rain over the next 2 weeks, they'll still have had pretty close to normal rainfall with anything going forward being a bonus. It looks like that bonus is going to happen once we get about 10 days out. There's another system that'll move through, and that should produce some thunderstorms in Argentina from around February 25th to the end of the month. And if that happens, then we'll have a pretty ideal rainfall setup for soybeans in particular, because February, which is kind of like their August, will have had wetter than normal weather.
Moving to the north of there, if you look into parts of Paraguay and southern Brazil, are things doing well still?
Well, they're drying out and they don't have as much rain in the forecast. This is particularly true in Paraguay. Now, Paraguay only produces about 10 million metric tons of soybeans, so even if they have a problem, it's not going to change the world balance sheets too much. But they are having a little bit of a problem, and that's going to continue, so that'll be something to watch. To the immediate east of Paraguay are the key growing regions of southern Brazil. They've also been a little bit dry, and they would also benefit from rain. So this story is not completely done yet, even though it is getting late in the season, because they will see 1.5, maybe even 2.5 to 3 inches of rain across southern Brazil over the next 2 weeks. But you need to keep in mind how wet their climate is. They receive about 3 inches of rain every 2 weeks at this time of the year. So even if they get that, it won't be enough to make up for these deficits that have built up over the last 4 to 5 weeks.
And I take it that things have been okay in the center west as of recent?
Well, yeah, they've been receiving a pretty decent mix of dry and wet periods, and that's going to last here for a few more days. Right now, they're in one of those dry periods, and that's helping out with soybean harvesting as well as second crop corn planting. Now, as we move forward, it's going to turn pretty stormy in these areas, so that will all slow down as we move through next week. But you need to keep in mind that there are a lot of soybeans that are planted a little bit later, and those are going to benefit from this event, especially as you move north into the region that we call Mato Piba, which is around 10 to 15% of Brazil's soybeans. So they'll be seeing some pretty nice rains going forward.
And finally, here in the U.S., it's been very mild. Can we expect it to stay that way in the Midwest?
Well, it's certainly going to last for a couple more weeks. This is all due to the effects of the strong El Nino that's been affecting our weather pattern over the last 3 to 6 months. Now, once they move into March and April, which is coming up pretty quick here, the effects of El Nino typically diminish across the United States, and that's because of a whole bunch of different factors that start to come into play. So even though we can see it's going to stay mild over the next 2 weeks, and we know this is due to the El Nino, it's very difficult to say how much into March that's going to last and what's going to follow beyond that. So things will more than likely start to get a little more volatile once they move about 4 to 8 weeks out. But for the near term, pretty much status quo with a lot of mild weather, but not as wet as it has been. It'll be pretty dry in the plains for a little bit with only some rain and snow in the eastern corn belt.
Hey, thank you much, Mike.
Yeah, have a great day, Todd.
Mike Tenor is with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net online. You've been listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Don't forget to visit our website at willag.org. And there today, you can still buy your tickets for the all-day ag outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. That's coming up on Tuesday, March the 5th. I hope to see you there. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Our theme music is written, performed, and produced by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.